Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
How are you, sweet Kelly?
I'm doing good. I have my friend Brad in town. He's in the studio with us.
Hi.
Brad, How are you doing? From San Francisco.
I am.
Nice.
Happy to be here.
Yeah. A little break from the weather.
Absolutely. Love coming down here.
Nice. Are you here for business or pleasure?
For business, but also to see my friend and to see this radio show that I've listened to many times and love hearing.
He's probably our best fan, right?
Exactly, exactly.
What did they used to say on one of those radio shows? I think it was Kiss FM or something. Uh-huh. I have one of seven listeners or something like that. So you're one of our three listeners,
My
right?
mom yeah, is the other, are, you know, makes up the other.
Times 100,000.
Yeah, actually, we do. We have probably like about 150,000 listeners at this point.
It's great.
That's pretty awesome. So before we go any further, we do want to recognize our sponsor. We have a great sponsor for the show, and her name is Kim Gold. She's the author of the business memoir Gold Standard, How to Rock the World and Run an Empire. This book is called A Front Row Seat to a Huge Upheaval, not only in her own life, but in American business, as it comes to grips with the kind of woman who is here to change the game. Leah Remini says Kim's achievements in business will leave one in awe. That's a given. And Mark Burnett notes that Kim always takes action on her instinct and seems to win time and time again. Gold Standard by Kim Gold is available on Amazon.com. Now. She's great. Yeah.
Yeah, we love
Kim.
Her.
We're so honored to have her as a sponsor. If you do feel so inspired to give us a call during the show, we have a great guest today. Our phone number is 323-203-0815. Again, 323-203-0815. But let's catch up, Kelly.
Yeah, so
how are you? How was your weekend?
I was just saying, it's been the longest weekend ever because my kids didn't have school yesterday. I did a lot. I did a lot of things. We went to the Discovery Cube, which was great. Remy made like a fast friend with like another wild kid.
Oh, nice.
So that worked out well. And then I went ice skating in Burbank and had the best time. And they have these little seals for like little kids that they can push.
Aww.
And so, or you can sit.
Yes.
And so, you know, I mean, it was really funny. London's pretty athletic, so he was doing decent, you know, as a three-year-old. Remy was struggling a little bit. You know, he liked more when we pushed him along, but it was so much fun. I love ice skating.
Did
so
you
I
fall?
Had a blast. No, I didn't fall.
Good job. Oh, so you're a good ice skater.
I'm all right. I mean, it's not that hard. It's like, I used to rollerblade a little bit.
Okay.
But David's really good. He can like go backwards and I don't know. I'm just kind of like, all right, I'll stay the course for now.
Do you know that was one of my passions as a young kid was ice skating and ice skating lessons. And
no.
I was pretty good. But like I said, my parents were just never on board with pressing for any sort of athletics or sports or anything like that.
Oh.
So when I sort of lost interest, they're like, fine. Give it up. So I only wish I would have kept that up.
Let's go together.
Piano. But, oh, I'm terrible now. I feel like my ankles would just like buckle right.
No, I bet you it's like riding a bike. You're going to get right back on there. I bet you'll be like, all right, let me do a little spin in the air. Like you'll
be fine. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That would be fun. I'd like to ride a horse on ice. I'm just kidding.
Crazy.
It's good imagery, though.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
What about you? What'd you do this weekend?
Well, Christopher and I actually went up north to the Buellton area, where, you know, Anderson's famous pea soup is in that
this
area.
This is so funny.
So it's kind of between, it's right between Solvang and Lompoc.
Got it. I know exactly.
I think it's Lompoc, not Lompoc. I think it's Lompoc. Anyway, so we got to see the space launch out there. It was very hysterical because we had gone to a couple wineries and we met some of the people that were working on the launch. And Tiffany, my daughter's new boyfriend, his brother lives down in that area. So he was going to meet up with us, but he couldn't because he had to be busy with this thing. So we're like, okay, where can we see the launch? So there was this hotel that was close to ours and you could stand on this balcony. And so we were like looking at our phones. What time is it going on? It's 10:42. And we kind of look around like, we're not going to be able to see this thing. And then all of a sudden we saw like this little like 3-inch light bar.
Oh my God.
Know, just traveling up and like, that was it. Like 5 seconds later, that was it.
That's so cool.
And they had said that in the town, you're going to hear noises and like sonic booms and all this stuff. Nothing. It was the most underwhelming thing. But all right. So we checked it off a bucket list that we never had on
it
anyway.
Did you video it?
it was so fast. It was so short. It was so little. I don't even know that. I mean, I tried to take a picture. The camera couldn't even pick it up.
Wow.
It probably would have had to have like a telephoto lens, and I didn't have that camera with
me. That's exciting, though. You still can say you saw it.
Exactly. So we had like a quick turnaround. You know, we just went up there overnight, hung out, took a nice long walk, had a great dinner out, and it was like, it just felt like getting away for a little bit. Yeah. Don't you envy my life?
No, I was just thinking that. How did you know? I'm thinking in my head, I cannot wait until, like, I can just go away for the weekend. Oh, I feel like going here. Oh, I feel like going there. Like, what a gift.
Well, and when you finally are able to do that, you know that you will have earned it because you will have worked so darn hard with your two boys. And then finally, you know, they'll be on their own and you'll say, geez, it's time for me.
Dude, London's still in diapers. I feel like I'm going to be walking him down the aisle in those things. I'm not kidding. He's still like, he's like refuses. I think it's like a control thing.
But he's only three. He just
He's like three. Yeah, he's like 3 and 2 months. But he knows.
He'll do it.
Anyway.
He's punishing you for something.
He
you
is.
Just don't
he's
know
just
what.
Like, because I know you want it. Well, I told you we're going away to this resort in Hawaii and they need to be body trained. I'm like, I got 2 months. I got to get this sucker out.
Oh,
so
boy.
Fine. Yeah.
Do you stress about it a lot?
No, it's fine. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. What am I going to do?
You'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
It'll be just another one of those moments in time where you go, ah, right? Ah. Anyway, so last week there was a bit of a, I guess, like a technology glitch in our show. So our show did not air live and it did not get recorded. But we did have an awesome guest on, James Connor, the Super Yogi Scenario. And I guess we're going to
try to get him back.
Again, he was awesome. He talked about his book, The Super Yogi Scenario, and he was just an all-around great guy. So sorry for that, James, and
for
all of his fans that were listening.
Exactly.
But it will happen. Will happen.
Well, he was so calm. Like, I really liked that. You know, when the technical issues was going on, it was really interesting because I kind of looked over at him, and here's this meditation guy who basically went on a retreat for 3 years. And he's just, it was like, he just had a lot of acceptance. Like, I think that my kind of first reaction would be like, wait, what? You know, like, what's going on? Or, you know, can I come back? Like, and he was just, he kind of went with the flow. So I appreciated that.
I guess that's what 12 years of consistent meditation will give you and 3 years at a retreat.
Yes, exactly.
A lot of calmness there.
Yeah.
Well, today we have an exciting guest, and as far as we know, technology is working just fine.
We're
great. Live and we are recording, and we have Maggie Knipe, who is going to talk with us about her new book, Now Everyone Will Know, The Perfect Husband, His Shattering Secret, My Rediscovered Life. Maggie is a veteran of the publishing industry with a career spanning 20 years as a publicity and marketing executive at,
Bertelsmann?
Bertelsmann, Scholastic Incorporated, and Abrams Books. Known for her innovative marketing plans and spectacular events, Maggie regularly amplified stories by, about, and for women throughout her career. She won the 2002 Scholastic Exceptional Marketing Award for an annual reading initiative she created called Read for 2000. Classrooms all over the world read at the same time for 2,000 seconds. Oh, that's so cool.
That is so cool.
Yeah. When not championing women, working at a nonprofit, writing, running, and slipping into dance class, Maggie can be found performing as a singer as Manhattan clubs like the Laurie Beachman Theater and the Metropolitan Room. Maggie graduated with degrees in English and theater from the College of William and Mary and received a Master of Fine Arts in Dance from Sarah Lawrence College. She lives in Westport, Connecticut and has 2 grown children. Maggie, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much. I love being on this show. I love listening to you guys. This is part of my bucket list to talk to you, and I'm jealous of you having so much fun over the holiday weekend.
What did you do over the holiday weekend?
Well, you can appreciate this. At my stage of life, I hate to promote another book, but there's a book about how cleaning and organizing can be meditative, and that's what I did almost all weekend. Because once your kids leave the nest, you start to clean up. And boy, have your fun now, because once they do, you'll be boxing and unboxing and purging, and tears will be rolling down your face as you look at your cute kids when they were little. So
Kelly's not there yet. Hers are little munchkins, 6 and 3, and
adorable.
My daughter is 23, so I'm in your boat. I get
okay, so you can relate.
I can,
I know. So that's for another, I guess, another segment.
Yeah,
exactly. But we would really love to hear more about your story and your book, and it's a very, very important piece. So now, you know, at turning 60, I guess that's what inspired
although
you.
Although now everyone knows that I've turned 60, but that's okay. I'm in a good place, so that's okay.
I love your energy, though. You really sound youthful, and you know, so I love that.
Yeah, I feel really good, and I feel even better now that I've written this story about what happened 25 years ago that I couldn't talk about. I will say that I was reading something recently, and as we know, we honored nationally Martin Luther King yesterday, and he said, I learned, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. That's one of his famous quotes.
Yes.
And I had to be silent, as you know, for a long time about what happened to my very wonderful husband a quarter of a century ago. So I can talk about that now if you like.
Yes, please.
We would love that.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So basically, my book, Now Everyone Will Know, is about a big secret I had to keep when, again, 25 years ago, I was married to this wonderful man, and I had just had my second child, and 3 weeks, and my husband had not been feeling well. Now, let's think back, so those of us who can, to the late 80s and early 90s, in cities like L.A. and New York and big cities, when lining the streets were some very exceptional people, many of them young men who were very ill with AIDS.
Uh-huh.
And it was very visible and very prevalent in major American cities. And I lived in a little bit of a cocoon in a town right outside New York across the Hudson River called Hoboken, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a very wonderful life, an idyllic life, the one I wanted. I had been from my bio you just extrapolated from, I had been a singer and dancer and had a wonderful time doing that, but had then met the man of my dreams. And so I was married, two kids. My husband wasn't feeling well for a while. And then after our second child was born, he fell gravely ill in a restaurant on his 36th birthday.
Wow.
And failed to be able to speak. He was a journalist. He was a man of words.
Wow.
This was particularly shocking. Although he was a quiet man, not a verbose one, he was very, very bright. And so his incapacity to speak was just shocking. It would be in anybody, but especially in him. The next morning, to move along with this, he woke up looking pretty normal, sounding normal, but within a matter of hours, it was determined that he was failing again, and he was hospitalized. And I actually guessed, shockingly, that he might have AIDS.
Wow.
And the doctor could not really figure out why, but I had that sixth sense because I'd been a performer, and so many people had been sick at the restaurants at which I'd worked, in the plays I was in. And so that was the beginning of keeping this big secret. Again, I had a three-week-old son.
Wow.
God. And I had a two-and-a-half-year-old daughter, and I had to, classically circle the wagons. No one could know what was wrong with John. And the title comes from a moment I had with him when I had brought him home from the hospital. Mm-hmm. They had done what they could for him. Back then, there wasn't even sufficient treatment for AIDS. There was a drug called AZT,
right,
but it didn't do a lot to help people live for any length of time. He was really quite sick. And I said, he said to me when I took him home, and he said, "Now everyone will know I have AIDS." And I said, "Why do you say that?" Determined that no one would know. And he said, "Because you're going to tell them." Because I was a very, as you can see, I was an energetic person. I loved to laugh and tell stories and sing and dance. And he called me his original spark of life. He loved that in me.
Mm.
But he wasn't right, because no one could know about this disease because of its stigma.
Right.
We were tested, and I was negative. I was tested as the mother of two small children, and if the mother is negative, the children will be. But as little as people knew about AIDS then, no one believed that.
Oh.
And that's the story, and the rest of the story, you can jump in any time, but the book is really about how once those aforementioned children grew up and left, and I went back and did a reconnaissance, and this was my rediscovered life, and I followed the footsteps of AIDS, tried to find it, saw films, saw plays, did the AIDS walk in New York, and realized that I had been so isolated as a woman because of this being a largely gay man's disease that I really couldn't connect to it, but I needed to face it. I needed to look at it to forgive and let John, the memory of John, rest. I was also, one other reason for writing this book was to bring him back in a way, because we were so afraid to talk about him all those years, because any mention of him would bring back the inevitable question, how did he die?
Right.
And then I thought, now that everybody was pretty much safe from stigma and on their own and having their own lives, I could then finally
share it.
Tell the truth about him. Yes, and share it, yes.
So he died, 9 months after the formal diagnosis?
Yes, it was about 8.5 months, somewhere between 8.5 and 9 months that he died. He was very quick. He was very ill.
And what did you end up telling people when they asked?
So at first, you know, I did, you know, I was kind of like throwing it out and seeing if it sticks. You know, I have to say that at first we sort of tried cancer, mm-hmm. but the questions that came in were, well, what kind of cancer? And, you know, I have a great brain doctor. Mm-hmm. And, of course, then we were at sea. You know, I didn't know what to say next.
Right.
Finally, I had to sort of just didn't talk about him at all. It was very, very soon after he died, in fact, and during his illness, I stopped talking about him. We had moved him to an apartment. He was so ill. In the city, his brother's apartment, and we just sort of had two separate stories, although people knew in town, mm-hmm. but I was just hoping they would sort of leave us alone because mm-hmm. we were well, so I was just, you know, sort of like a wing and a prayer. As the years went by, we really simply did not talk about him. If people asked, we'd say, we don't really want to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
It was very difficult. It's a very difficult public information issue, keeping this kind of secret.
Wow. Imagine carrying that.
No,
wow.
What a burden. I mean, in hindsight now, with what you've, all your years of wisdom and all that, would you do it the same based on the conditions the way it was then? Do you still feel like that was the best way to go?
I have no doubt in my mind that it was the best way to go. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm someone who does not keep secrets easily, and I do not tell, you know, cloud the truth easily. It's not comfortable for me. For many people, it's not comfortable to either tell lies or to keep secrets. But this was something I had to accept for the safety of my family and for their reputation and mine, and also because I was ashamed. And I think it's important to mention that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real issue of shame in sort of what we call now mixed orientation marriages. And by that I mean one partner is mixed orientation, mm-hmm. gay or bi. And I know this because since writing the book, some of these people have found me and I have found them through something called the Straight Spouse Network. And within our fluid society today, increasingly fluid and open society, there are many people in marriages who are coming out. And spouses sometimes are the untold stories. The straight spouse is not really the person who's either understood or listened to, mm-hmm. or even forgiven. It's a very odd positioning.
That's amazing that you found that, because I would think that would be so comforting to find other people in the similar situations.
That's what I missed. And now that I've found, I've been, since publishing my book, which is available on Amazon, which people are seeming to read with some degree of eagerness. I also had an online article on Time.com. From what we call AIDS widows found me. And as women, we were feeling very isolated over the years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a lot of public information and public outcry and public recognition of AIDS. There was celebrity-driven, support. There was political support. There were marches.
Yeah.
There were films or documentaries. There was outcry. But very rarely did you see a woman in that mix,
wow.
a wife and a mother.
Mm-hmm.
You would see sisters and mothers of victims. There's no question about it. There were women. But in the role of a wife or in the role of the mother of,
yeah.
of children, we were not present.
Wow. I know.
Wow. Hang on one sec. If you just tuned in, we are talking with Maggie Knipe, who's telling us about her book that is out now called Now Everyone Will Know, The Perfect Husband, His Shattering Secret, and My Rediscovered Life. Wow, what an intense story. Oh, my gosh. Maggie, if you will, I'm sure you learned a lot about this, and it might be very helpful to our listeners. I mean, most people hear the words HIV and AIDS, and they can sometimes overlap and confuse one another. Do you have some helpful distinguishing?
I mean, I do. I don't want to be perceived as a medical authority on this. And over the years, the virus has changed. And certainly when Charlie Sheen just came out
mm-hmm.
about this, I think that's a great example of people not yet really understanding the distinction. Because a lot of us don't want to hear about AIDS. We want to think that it's gone away. And I don't blame anybody for that, especially those of us who lived during its very tragic climax here in this country.
Right.
HIV is the virus, is the HIV virus that causes acquired immune deficiency syndrome. Acquired immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS, are the infections that are caused by this virus. At the
right.
time that John was first sick, they were learning about it, so that even complicated the situation further. But the virus can be dormant for several years and not show itself before the first infection.
Mm-hmm.
People today, of course, there's incredibly progressive and successful medication that people can take prophylactically, and mm-hmm. also and they can be treated with it. It's a different situation. In many countries, and ours in particular, you don't normally, in many cities, you don't see the face of AIDS.
Right.
I think that people are more HIV. They're taking medication. Mm-hmm. So I hope that was clear enough.
Yes, that was very
helpful. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. Absolutely. I mean, you lived through this, so it would be interesting, because what you're saying is by the time John was sick, he was already in full-fledged AIDS.
That's right. He had what they call full-blown AIDS. He had little infections in the year before, mm-hmm. skin infections. He was exhausted, sort of viruses. Mm-hmm. Not any one of those things would have led me to believe that he had AIDS until I looked back in a sort of a flashback on the doctor, and I realized that he had been sick over and over again.
Well, I'd like to, if you will, bring you back to that moment. What was kind of that first reaction when it dawned on you, like, oh my God, he could have AIDS?
I think it was just, you know, it's very hard. As much as I remember this in many ways as though it were yesterday, I still see exactly where I was standing in my condominium, the answering machine flashing many, many messages from doctors. And I remember standing there and actually hearing myself ask, could this be AIDS, and not having that being premeditated.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It just was a light bulb.
Yeah. Wow. Unbelievable.
And that's very hard. I'm sure that with your experts, the two of you having your expertise in your areas, I suppose that is possible, that you're in denial for a long time, or something is lying dormant in you, and then you have a moment and it's just like, it's not exactly a eureka moment. It's quite the opposite. It's a very depressing and sad and scary moment. But something does dawn on you in that way.
Absolutely. Oh, I'm wondering if you went through any feelings of betrayal.
Absolutely. I think that that's a feeling that is a universal feeling. I would say the betrayal was secondary to hard and fast fear that I was also ill. So I think the first feeling was, mm-hmm. are we all sick?
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
And I had to really be tested and face the 24 hours, or to 40, I think it was 48 hours before I got the result.
Oh.
But I was more concerned about, honestly, about if we were really going to be ill and perhaps not live very long.
Sure.
After that, and in the months following, I felt terribly and, you know, painfully betrayed, yes.
Mm, my God, I can imagine.
Wow. So now what did you end up telling your children when they were young?
Right.
Well, I sort of had to, you know, when you have, everyone who has to deal with explaining death to children, first of all, there are many good books. I happen to work in children's books.
Oh.
So I knew there was this book called Freddie the Leaf. There were books about losing, the loss of people.
Mm-hmm.
But I really very organically determined that right about the time each was five, I talked with them about what their father, whom, by the way, they did not know. I mean, my son was 3 weeks old when his father was diagnosed. So mm-hmm. my daughter was just three when he died. So it isn't as though they could associate what I was telling them with a person, so it took them my son.
Right.
But I had to media train them so that when they got questions, where's your daddy, mm-hmm. they would know what to answer. And it couldn't be AIDS.
Right.
And so that, and when they were five, they seemed conscious enough and capable of handling that information, processing it.
Wow, that's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. I first of all, I just want to say I really applaud your bravery and your courage to speak out and just what you went through. I mean, really, it's incredible.
Absolutely. I second that and more.
Yeah, exactly. Wish I could hug you.
I think when you're in this, and this is for the people with us today, there are so many brave people out there and so many people with stories they can't tell. And we if we have a minute to consider people, we need to be, I think, sensitive to people who may be a little quieter than usual or not wanting to engage. They may have something that they're ashamed of or they can't really bring forth. And I have a renewed appreciation for that in people, having been through this myself. Mm-hmm. There are many, many courageous people out there dealing with situations in their families that are difficult.
So on a much smaller scale, I can certainly relate, because I was in a very abusive relationship for 7 years with a sociopath. And the front the front cover, if you will, was everybody sort of saw this happy-go-lucky woman in this relationship sort of protecting this image that people had of us. Meanwhile, I was hiding in closets and, you know, not wanting to come out and fearing my life and being threatened that I was going to be killed and all of that. And it was really disturbing. And when I finally broke free and said, you know, to my family and friends, you know, this was really bad, nobody believed me.
Right.
Because nobody saw it. You were just, you know, you were hugging and kissing him at a dinner. You know, it's like, well, that's the front that you had to portray. And sadly, years later, people often don't believe me when I say that my relationship is good. Now, I have a good relationship because, and they still don't even believe the depths of what that was like because they didn't live it. So I really can relate. And I am somebody who cannot keep secrets or I get such anxiety if even like the slightest thing I forgot to tell Christopher or if I said something that wasn't quite right, you know, just because maybe I wanted to feel better about myself or embellish something.
Right.
I get all that anxiety.
So imagine that said, and I'm deep-seated respect for you. Imagine if you couldn't say anything to anyone, and that's what this was like.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, I can only have a very small-scale ability to relate, so it's got to be profoundly upsetting. Brad, our in-house guest of Kelly's, would like to ask a question.
Okay. Hi, I'm very much enjoying listening to your story. I was wondering if a couple of the major cultural events in this subject area affected your thought process at all. One being when Magic Johnson, I think back in 91, announced that he was HIV positive, and it sort of became much more a mainstream acceptance at that point. And then I'm also wondering about Arianna Huffington and her husband coming out, and that sort of being the first time that sort of subject matter was really discussed nationally.
Mm-hmm. And there was also, this is a very good question. There was also Mary Fisher at the Republican National Convention coming out and having AIDS. My feeling about those events is that I sat glued to the TV at the time, and I saw Magic Johnson's wife sitting with him, and I thought, this is helpful. But my feeling about those events, and Arianna Huffington, or Stephanopoulos Huffington, her husband was, I guess, I don't know if he died of AIDS. Did he die of AIDS? I don't know if he died, but there was a husband coming out as gay, and there was some husband dying of AIDS. Magic Johnson is alive and well, thankfully, and still with us. But I think people in the public were naturally protected by their celebrity. They could speak and they could amplify their stories, and people would sort of know who they were and could get the full information about their situations through the media. So I was, from afar, I was quietly, not glad for them, but glad that this was now in public eye, this possibility. However, personally, I was not helped at all by it. Still the people on the train going to work. There were still the other parents at school.
Right.
There was still just that one person who could say, did you know?
Sure.
Are we sure? That kind of thing.
And
yes, I was affected on a macro level, on a larger scale, of course. On a smaller one, not at all. Disappointingly, not at all.
And you talk a little bit about how some members of the local community knew and they were not welcoming. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I will say that there were people who, it was very surreptitious, but I would notice people crossing the street when I was walking on a relative of my late husband's, an elderly relative who could never understand AIDS, refused to shake my hand.
Aww.
These injustices, you know, obviously hit me very hard.
Sure.
From a distance, I understand how these people felt.
Mm-hmm.
They knew very little about the disease. They were afraid.
Right.
On the flip side, there were some people who were just incredible.
Aww.
And so you learn the best and worst of people when you have a situation like this.
Yes. Wow. Well, I remember, I remember like the late 80s, I mean, watching a segment on that boy, his name was Ryan. He was like
Ryan White.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. And they were talking, I remember they were giving like a little education at the end of the documentary about it. And I mean, it was even questionable whether you should drink from the same glass as somebody who was HIV positive. So I think even back then it was like, we're not quite sure. We don't know for certain. So, you know, it's probably safe not to drink from a glass.
Right. And this went on for some years.
Yeah.
I even think now, I was watching the Today Show interviews with Charlie Sheen and some of what he wasn't, I mean, I think it was, people still were confused about how AIDS is transmitted. And how many years later is this? 25 years later.
Yes.
Yeah.
So true. Unbelievable,
but believable. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. So now, when did you actually first open up to your children about the truth? I suspect that was longer before you wrote the book.
Well, in the book, part of my my rediscovered life was that when each of my children graduated from college, they mentioned their father, which mm-hmm. I thought was poetic mm-hmm. and moving.
Yep.
Where is he? And I'm thinking of him, despite the fact they hadn't known him. You know, your commencement is you're commencing into your own life, and so this was very poignant to me. So I write about this in the book. I pulled out. Olive John was a fairly well-known journalist. He worked at the Wall Street Journal, and I pull all his clips and a lot of the stuff that I had boxed up and taped. Some of the stuff I'm going through now again when I say I'm cleaning up my boxes and my use the term delicately hoard. and I wanted to then reacquaint the kids with their late father, and I tried to really sort of what I call Photoshop us all together again. You know, the father they didn't really know.
Sure.
And they were not enthusiastic about it.
Oh,
and I was feeling very lonely. I thought, well, all, you know, because I really, not only did I love this man, but I thought a lot of him. He was very bright. I married him for all the right reasons, I thought. And he was their father. I wanted to sort of let them know the best of their father after all the years we had not talked about him.
Mm-hmm.
And each of them then made it clear to me that they were going to get to know him in their own lives in their own way. So I've never really been able to talk too much to them about it. And I've learned that that's okay. And that's something I really did learn from the process of writing this book, that my relationship with my husband was my relationship. I was the one who knew him. I had it. They did not mm-hmm. in this particular case.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that if a parent dies and children have grown up with that parent, it's a very different situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was sort of it was artificial. And so I think that each of my kids who are now grown up and into their own lives in his or her own way will either will or won't one day find a way to relate to their late father.
Yeah.
It's not really, I've sort of sent them off. I've done what I could, and it's now their decision.
Sure. Well, I'm curious how your feelings have changed about your husband since writing the book. Now everyone will know. I can imagine a slew of feelings both before and after.
I would say my feelings have done about a 180. I think that writing, I think the art writing, for those out there who write or who aspire or who, you know, sit down and put thoughts into on paper or on the computer, it can be very therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
You really, really have to think about what happened or how you really feel. It did take me 6 years. And so over those 6 years, I wrote through anger, I wrote through fear. I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would write something I remembered that I had not remembered. And so recalling it has helped me let it go. It really took that to let it go. And I do think that people will tell you when you suffer a tragedy like this, you know, can't you just let it go, they say?
Mm.
You know,
right.
You know, haven't you let that go already, they say to you. Mm. And no,
right.
You don't.
And,
you try, but you don't.
Yeah.
So I think the writing of the book was utterly therapeutic.
Oh, yeah. I so agree with you, Maggie, that writing, and I know Kelly does writing too. I do blogging and have written books, and it's just, it is so therapeutic because it really forces you to be with yourself and your thoughts and your feelings
mm-hmm.
in a really intimate way that just sort of driving your car and thinking about something does not do.
Mm-hmm.
So applaud you for doing that. And as we know, time doesn't really heal wounds. It's an active process of doing something with those memories and feelings that get us through to the next phase. So how, if you could help our listeners, I'm sure that so many people go through shameful moments in their lives, probably not to this degree on average, but mm-hmm. what would be some tools or some strategies, if you will, as to how to move through that shame?
Okay. Well, first of all, I want to say that what is available to people now that I don't think was nearly available at all to me years ago, and over the years it was more available, but I was kind of like an ostrich, you know,
mm-hmm.
the head in the sand concept, are these private websites that have people who are dealing with what you're dealing with, and you can relate to them in a private way.
Mm.
And they are available in every area of challenge and stress in people's lives. So I think the first thing you do is you find privately people with whom you can connect.
Sure.
In this case, I would mention again, and I'm not affiliated, I just have to say, having found the Straight Spouse Network
right.
online, it's a very useful website. There are a lot of opportunities to connect through that website.
That's
so, and
awesome.
That is for mixed orientation marriage, mixed orientation relationship. I would also say, and I did this, that I had the great benefit of a mental health provider, or in this case, a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. over the years. And so for me, that was very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
This may seem like a lightweight remedy, but I'm very athletic.
Mm-hmm.
I ran marathons. It helped me to just sort of, running was very meditative. And
yeah.
so for me, that was a personal way I could help myself.
That's great.
And also you find a few people you know you can trust. And that's that's not easy to do.
Sure.
Sometimes you make a misstep, you know, someone you thought you could trust, you actually can't. But if you can, friendship is very valuable.
I was just going to ask you that. Did you ever run across a friend who you thought was trustworthy and this person betrayed you or?
Yes. Yeah. In the book, there's I'll sort of leave it to people to read in the book. I'm,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm not being a tease, but it was a very personal and dramatic thing that happened to me. Someone who was a close friend did really betray my trust, and it was very, mm-hmm. very dramatic and painful result.
Oh.
And it's something it's hard for me to talk about, but it's in the book. And it's just really hard to talk about. It involved the care of my children, and my children were the most precious people in my life at that time. So I had a very shocking and stark encounter with a friend who really turned her back on me and did, in fact, betray me.
Wow. So
and
sorry.
When that happened during the course of my husband's illness, I trusted no one for some months more. I just couldn't.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. It was further isolating.
And increasing that sense of shame, I'm sure.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well.
Oh, the sense of shame was an overwhelming, protracted feeling. The sense of shame, being married to a man who, and this has changed to some degree. People are very much more open about their lifestyle and the media is, and it's a different world from 25 years ago. But being married to a gay or bisexual man, people were very judgmental about that.
Oh,
didn't you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Did you cause him to be that way? You got a lot of questions
dear.
Like that.
Oh my, that's got to be just horrifying to hear something like that.
You know, all of a sudden your sex life is like, you know, under the microscope.
Right.
And another byproduct of this.
Right.
So the shame is something that was very hard to beat back. I have through writing the book. It really did take the writing of the book.
Also had such a big cultural message, too. I don't know if you grew up in this way, Kelly, but the idea that you don't air your dirty laundry, right? You don't talk about things,
mm-hmm.
about family and all that stuff, maybe in the privacy of a therapist.
Yes.
But
yes.
even going to a therapist was a stigma.
Yes.
So
yes.
I know that was a big, big one in my family of origin was, you know, you keep these things to yourself and it's nobody's business.
That's right. My family, too, my wonderful mother and father, everyone, don't talk about it. Don't tell anyone. My father, I grew up partly in Detroit, and Henry Ford II once said, upon being arrested, I believe, never complain, never explain.
Mm-hmm.
This was my father's mantra.
Mm-hmm.
Never complain, never explain. And so today, people feel that everything's online. Everything's, you know, there's too much exposure, too much self-proclamation. There is a happy medium.
Right.
But it's a much better time to tell the truth.
Although, it's curious, I still don't think that most people tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I think people tell the truth that they want people to see, so it inspires a more positive image of themselves.
Right.
I mean, I don't know.
But I think it's gotten a lot better, obviously. Yeah, over time. I mean,
in relationships, however, what better time than now in relationships? In love and sexual relationships, what better time than now to at least try to be honest?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's a good time
I applaud people trying to be honest.
This is why I love that you wrote this, because I feel like honesty is contagious. And if one person is honest, then other people can come forward and, you know, or at least not feel so alone. So that's why I'm so happy you wrote this.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm happy. Every time someone tells me that he or she, and there are he's who are glad I wrote this, it makes me all the more glad to have written it.
Yes.
Absolutely. And I think you made such an interesting and important point when you talk about it was different for someone like Magic Johnson or Magic Johnson's mm-hmm. family. We do tend to elevate celebrities to a status where we give them so much more.
Yes, slack.
Slack, if
slack,
you will,
yeah.
right? I mean, we're so much less punishing of them,
right.
whereas, you know, for you to not be a celebrity and to come out with all this and, you know, just be somebody who could be your next door neighbor.
Right. Although, right. But it is interesting with the Charlie Sheen, I'd love to hear your thoughts too, that I feel like he got the opposite reaction.
More negativity than you would have thought?
A lot of negativity.
Well, Charlie Sheen, you know, I mean, look, I know he's a neighbor of yours, I'm sure, out in L.A. I mean, he's great. I used to love to watch him, you know, in Two and a Half Men. He's a wonderful comedic actor. Yes. But his lifestyle was such that people judged right away.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, if you pardon me, Charlie, gone off the rails a little bit recently.
Right.
So people were, of course it happened to him, they said, you know.
Right.
So he wasn't the best candidate to be cast in a sort of an affirming light having this disease.
Right. Sure.
He also had to hide it himself at this time, this sort of more open time. It's interesting to the lengths to which he went to hide having it.
Oh my gosh, mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I bet there's a lot more celebrities that we don't know about that are still in hiding. I bet. I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think...
Yeah, go ahead.
No, sorry. I was just going to say, people, they do. They look at you differently. I mean, you know, and I think that we, like you said, we're 25 years out, but I think there is still that question of like, okay, wait, can I still get it? Or how? Or, you know, oh no, you know, that's scary, the fear.
I think people are, of course, less afraid of it now. Because it, you know, it can be managed. I do think people were very afraid when Charlie Sheen brought up a lot of fear, brought fear to the mm-hmm. surface in people's reactions.
Right.
They knew that he was married, he had children. So people, I think, I don't think AIDS is something people still like to talk about. And when I wrote this book, I wasn't sure how many people would read it because it did concern AIDS. But it's been interesting to me how many people are reading it and how many people relate to it in a more broad sense.
Nice.
That of obviously family secrets, family communication mm-hmm. in relationships, how the importance of being honest, which I agree. I think it's very important. I mean, how many people are really honest? But to be as honest as you can be, especially with your primary partner, isn't that what a relationship? Isn't that a healthy relationship?
I mean, we would like to think so.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I always find it still startling to me. I still work with a lot of, you know, youngsters in their 20s and 30s, right? And still surprises me how many people they're in these new relationships and, you know, they're sexual. And I say, are you practicing safe sex? Oh, no, it's not a problem. I don't need to worry. And it's really... Really? I mean, I think still with all that education and all that, I mean, definitely know that it can be contracted mm-hmm. through sexual intercourse and to just... somebody you don't even know, you know, you've been seeing them for 2 or 3 weeks to believe that they're being honest with you about that. I don't know.
I do think it has changed a little bit. I mean, when I was growing up, I feel like the message was really drilled in, like use protection, you know, all these, you know, and that was, I mean, when you were talking about 1991, I mean, I was in sixth grade. So like I was, you know, 12. So it was probably like the height of it where they were really, you know, drilling it in with the teenagers. But like, you know, I remember like walking down in Georgetown, people were giving out condoms sometimes. Like it was very, you know, it was very aware, but I feel like they've kind of, I don't know, it doesn't feel as strong anymore today.
Almost like a pendulum or something.
Yeah.
But I guess the thing that happens is because there is such a sort of the culture at large says things like, well, you probably deserve to get it then because you didn't do whatever. You know, people think that way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then it's definitely, though, for someone like a young woman or man who engages in sexual intercourse with somebody and doesn't use protection, they can contract all kinds of other sexually transmitted diseases. And then they feel like they have to hide afterwards because they start to feel like it was, well, if only I had, mm-hmm. and now it is my fault. And then there's that whole vicious cycle that goes along with that as well.
Right. I mean, the best thing, I mean, not to sound like, you know, an old fuddy-duddy, and guess what? P.S., I probably am one. I'm certainly the age of one. I think it's better to be safe than sorry.
Of course.
I think it's better to know what's out there and to say, I need to protect myself. But, you know, I'm not 21, and I'm not out having fun in a club. But I do think that there's a little, you know, there's not a lot of, people aren't alarmed anymore by this. And and to your point, I don't know who said this. But I do think that there's a lot out there besides this. And I do think that it's just better to be safe.
Yeah.
And also, this is an interesting problem. This is now happening in the senior world. I don't know if you've heard this.
Oh, really? No.
Right. The people who are, you know, who are people out there, you know, people are living longer, they're more sexually active later, and they're divorced, and they're out there again with new partners, and no one knows really where they've been or who they've been with if they're out there, so they're not using condoms either. So it's a smart thing to use one. It's a smart thing to know who you're with. It's a smart thing to tell the truth and be told the truth, too. So if you feel like you're not getting the truth, you might want to ask a few questions is my advice here. I know I will now. I mean, I'm like, you know, the FBI now when it comes to being.
No, blame you, for sure. Well, we're almost out of time. You were so wonderful. We've been talking to Maggie Knipp, the author of Now Everyone Will Know. Can you give us some last parting words, anything that you want to say or any messages that you want to, you know, talk about?
Well, I want to thank both of you for having me on today, Dr. Debra and Kelly. This has been a wonderful conversation, at least from my point of view, and I really hope that we've been enlightening to people, and I hope that people will obviously go to Amazon and BN.com and buy my book, but also read the book, because I think it's been called a page turner. It's a real life dramatic story, but it's also, I hope, one that will help people. There's a reader's circle questions in the back you can quiz yourself on or talk with within your book club or friends.
Oh, that's great.
And I just hope you you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did today.
Absolutely. We absolutely did.
Oh my gosh, we were so honored to have you on. Thank you so much. And yes, for all of that just invaluable information for our listeners. We really, really appreciate it. So everybody, make sure you check out Maggie Knipp, and we're going to spell that K-N-E-I-P, the author of Now Everyone Will Know, The Perfect Husband, His Shattering Secret, My Rediscovered Life. Awesome interview. Thank you so much, Maggie.
Again, we love your energy, and you're so much fun. And thank you so much for doing
this. Thank you, Dr. Debra and Kelly. I really appreciate this. Have a wonderful rest of your, it's early there, right? Have a wonderful rest
afternoon.
Of Tuesday.
Thank you.
Thanks so
thank
much.
You.
Bye-bye.
Okay, and thanks a lot.
Wow.
So
how inspiring.
Yeah. Right?
Wow, what a thing to have to go through. I mean, just, I don't even have the right words for it.
Oh my God. Devastating.
Devastating.
Like, I was imagining kind of the feelings that I would feel if that happened to me. And there's just, I mean, you have to come across all of that, the sadness, the fear, the anger. I mean, because there's, you know, and it's kind of, I think a lot of times people think that, you know, you just sort of are stuck with one emotion, but you really can kind of have them all at once, I can imagine.
Absolutely.
You know?
And also to go through like the Rolodex in your mind, like, well, should I have figured that out?
Yes.
Was there signs that I missed and all of that? And like, you could do so many mind fucks with yourself that it just could go spinning. And it's always so inspiring when somebody takes that and they put their story out there and are willing to talk about it.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we need to also thank our sponsor, who is Kim Gold, the author of the business memoir Gold Standard, How to Rock the World and Run an Empire. And this book is called A Front Row Seat to a Huge Upheaval, not only in her own life, but in American business. She's an awesome lady, so people should check out Kim Gold, too, with her book.
And it's a great book.
It is a great book. She's a good storyteller. She's a lot of fun. And we're going to be meeting with her this week and find out some of her upcoming philanthropic adventures.
Projects.
So we can mention a few of those on air for her as well. So thank you, Kim, for having the trust and respect in Kelly and me. Yes, we really appreciate it. Okay, well, we're going to just keep our listeners in waiting for next week's show because we're not exactly sure if
what's
we are
gonna
confirmed,
happen.
So it could be a surprise.
Thank you so much. And check out our website, docandtherapist.com. We also have a Facebook page, Doc and Therapist.
Pretty easy, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You have any upcoming excitements this week? How long are you going to be here, Brad?
Oh, only for a day.
Oh.
It's such a pleasure to listen to the show today.
So
and I'm not a reader, but I'm picking up that book.
Yes.
Awesome.
It's really
Yay. Yeah, it's nice to have you in studio with us, too.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And thank you for your question. It was a really excellent question.
I love how you speak. You're so poignant. I love it. It was great. So thank you so much. All right, until next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.